This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, welcoming you to Living Dialogues. And for this particular dialogue, I'm delighted to have as my guest, Michael Mead, storyteller, mythologist, and itinerant teacher. Known to a number of you perhaps for his work in the men's movement, and now with his Mosaic Foundation. So, Michael, it's a real delight to have you here on Living Dialogues.
Good to talk with you, Duncan.
And so I think perhaps the first thing we could do, since you are indeed a bard, a storyteller, a mythologist, would be to perhaps invite you to begin with your own personal journey and how you came to this work and when you began to recognize that this was your calling. Perhaps some incident might come to you from your childhood that might be a harbinger or some kind of predictor of what was to come.
I don't think of anything right off the bat from childhood, but when I was 13 was a pivotal year for me, and two things, I guess, happened, and maybe they're significant of how things have gone for me since. On my birthday, my aunt almost accidentally gave me a copy of Edith Hamilton's Greek Myths,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Which I immediately read and was delighted to find at the back of it a section on myths of other cultures, which I thought was very helpful to realize that there were many myths. And that same year, I was growing up in New York. And
in New York City?
In New York City. Mm-hmm. And then as we all see these days, the area was divided up into gangs. Mm-hmm. And the little crew that was our neighborhood gang, we were at a movie theater one day, and I went up to use the bathroom and found myself surrounded by seven guys from a rival gang, a bit older than our group, and armed with knives and monkey wrenches and things of the kind that we used to use. And all of a sudden, I was on the floor being threatened, and they were going to make an example of me because one of my friends had, I don't know, called them names or whatever happened. And it looked like I was just going to get annihilated right there. And without any real will on my part, a voice in me just began to speak and kind of make up a story, in a sense, about how the reason my friend would do such a foolish thing as to offend these powerful guys was that his father beat him every night, which was really pretty true. But
sure.
Also, it was true that their fathers beat them, and that's why they were carrying these little weapons around and so on. It was really mm-hmm. the story of most of the kids.
Sure.
And without knowing what I was doing, on a psychological level, I was disarming them. And then kind of, talking fast and making a story out of it. And they literally dropped, their arms dropped. They didn't drop the weapons, but their arms dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of stare that people have when they're about to do a lot of harm to someone disappeared. And the next thing, they were giving me a warning and letting me out of there. So in that one year, I began to study mythology in a book, which is one of the meanings of myth. Myth from the Greek mythos means to know the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the other meaning is to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are my first two experiences, kind of learning or trying to know the story And then in a kind of inspired by death drama, learning to tell the story or to convert my feelings and thoughts into a story. And right there I realized I had found something a lot more powerful than what everybody in the neighborhood thought was power. And I still think to this day that myth is probably the great power in the world, in the sense that it's the story everybody's in or trying to find again. And the lack of it is what's causing everybody to be so heavily armed and committed to violence right now.
And so is it the word myth, M-Y-T-H, that is from the Greek then, Michael?
Well, I think the Greek is M-U-T-H-O-S, mutos.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of meanings to it, but one way to look at it is it's the story, and then the other, it's the story when it's being told. So that people often separate myth and ritual, but the telling of the story is the mythic ritual, because when it's told, people have to open their entire set of ears all the way inside to hear a story. And when people are listening to a story, you can tell it when you see the rapt attention of an audience. The listeners have become momentarily whole, because you listen to a story with your whole self, your whole history and your whole imagination and your whole kind of purpose in life, to tell you the truth. And that's one reason why people need stories so badly, and why a culture suffers when there isn't a shared kind of overarching myth.
Absolutely. And what I'm thinking about, there are two or three things as you begin these opening verses, if you will, from this particular story. As Homer says in the beginning, "Sing to me of the man," when he's talking about Odysseus. And so we're doing that now in this very dialogue, and it recalls to me the feminine version of that, of course, would be one of them, Scheherazade.
Exactly.
Who literally kept the king entranced and enchanted for 1,001 nights in order to spare her own life, and in the process transformed the kingdom. And here I'm thinking also of this sense of listening, deep listening, where people are, as you say, listening with their whole selves. They become literally enchanted in the sense of entrained into a deeper and at the same time a higher kind of awareness of who they really are, above and below simultaneously the subconscious gossip or the story our intellect or our mind might tell us about who we are, and at the same time creating a resonance with the collective, with the whole, and ultimately with all of humanity, and for that matter all of history and all beings that exist, in fact all that is.
Yeah, a person has to meet the myth with their own story, which with their own life. And so in that sense, it's a full engagement. And the old idea was that to be part of the living myth, the telling of a myth, and the entering into it fully is by definition an act of healing and an initiatory event. So that when the stories were told, people would actually be entering it in order to change their lives. And in that sense, yes, it affects everybody, because when someone changes at a deep level, it affects essentially everyone they're related to and on from there.
And so, Michael, are you yourself from Celtic background, I take it?
Yes.
Are you all Irish, or do you have other strains in your ancestral lineage?
Well, I think there's no pure version of a myth, and there's no pure version of a person, near as I can tell. So both sides of my family are Irish, but I sure hope that they were, encountering other people and finding ways to connect, so I don't know. I'm part of that, the Irish that came to the United States or to the new land and tried to leave the old world behind. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know the connections back. And when I've gone to Ireland, the way I approach it is, since I don't know who my actual relatives are, I figure everybody there could be. And so I'm kind of have a mythic approach to ancestry.
I like it, you know, and it's very telling, too, that you yourself are, what, in your mid to late 50s now?
Just turned 60.
Just turned 60, an elder, just as I have. When was your birthday?
In January.
And mine was in March. Yeah, and this is a real significant milestone in one perspective of turning 60 and entering that decade of traditional elderhood. And I'm thinking that people of our generation had parents. Mine were Scottish on my father's side, Irish on my mother's side, who are often amazingly reluctant to tell the stories of their own ancestry. It's like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
And I think you said it beautifully there when you said your parents came from a generation which was leaving, in a sense, the old country, or perhaps their parents were leaving the old country and they were looking for the new world, and they actually embraced a kind of ahistorical, fresh start kind of view, whereas people of our generation and after us have become once again interested in reconnecting to the older stories.
Yeah, that there's that. They say you can only go as far forward as you can reach back.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the things we're faced with now in the world, I think, require a sense of deep ancestry, the sense that we didn't really arrive here just now, but that we're standing at the front of a long line of people who have experimented with similar things to what we're faced with. And then, since I love the stories, I want to connect back mm-hmm. to the stories, and the stories are connected to the land. Traditionally, I mean, if you're going to speak of Ireland or Scotland, but just to speak of Ireland, you're talking about the goddess. That's
sure.
She, matter of fact, Ireland has three names for three different aspects of the goddess, and people used to know that you came from that particular shape of Mother Earth, and so on. And that gives us a person a sense of having, what would you say, having a kind of a consistency in the world. I work a lot with gang kids and street kids, and they will tell you they have no future, but often what I find out is they have no past,
and they're interconnected.
Once you show them that, like I was just working with in the Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles, and tell them stories that connect, allow them to connect to their own ancestry, and suddenly they find a sense of dignity and a sense of belonging and a sense of even a purpose that is not possible if you are considered an alien or simply an immigrant or a refugee or someone just the children of people seeking jobs or whatever the foolishness of the moment is.
Sure. And in fact, that reminds me of that very interesting movie from New Zealand called Once Were Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such an excellent example of what you're talking about from a slightly different perspective, that the native Maoris who were there long before the white settlers had become, in a sense, refugees within their own land, strangers and aliens within their own land. And as a result, they had lost touch with their own deep, proud ancestral tradition, and alcoholism and abuse and violence out of the frustration and the rootlessness, the losing of their tradition and their connection to the land was rampant, and how the younger generation in that particular movie was beginning to make contact with the grandfather or the great-grandfather, great-grandmother that were still alive, that still had a living memory of the old ways, and finding ways to initiate themselves in connection with the elders. Very much what you're talking about here, and you're playing that role in this situation when you're working with the gang youth there in Los Angeles.
Well, when I mention it, what I notice is I'm doing the same thing I was doing when I was 13.
Yes.
And maybe that's what I've always been doing, is the two things that, the two hands I find myself having to work with mm-hmm. are the struggle for knowledge, but in particular, mythic knowledge, mythic ways of knowing, and then the requirement to test it in, you know, the rough road of reality. And it's, you know, if you do it long enough, I guess you have to start to notice, because there it is right there. Or often, like, I'll be in South Central LA, and then a few days later, I'm at Pacifica Graduate Institute, you know, working with PhD candidates in mythology,
mm-hmm.
after having just spent a week working the same material with kids, you know, kind of caught up in gang violence. And so maybe that was a very, I don't know what you would call it, a seed cracking period there at 13, because I really have done something of the two things ever since.
Well, you know what it also reminds me of, Michael, is the dialogue I had 4 or 5 years ago with Richie Havens, who also grew up in New York. He grew up in Brooklyn. Was that where you grew up?
Queens.
In Queens. And he was in Brooklyn. And he had the same experience as a young black boy, where the turf in his neighborhood was very much divided among 3 or 4 different gangs. And the way he and some of his friends found to actually survive in that situation was not to affiliate completely with one gang or the other, but to try to be a bridge, a membrane between them by forming a singing group. And he formed a little doo-wop singing group, which in a way is like you're telling the story, because he became a singing bard, if you will. And again, he entranced the gangs on each side and in some way managed to get safe passage as he navigated around the neighborhood and eventually migrated down to Washington Square in Manhattan, where he saw that people were actually able to make money by bringing out a guitar and supporting themselves. And so he taught himself the guitar, and then he began to play in clubs around there. And he was also an artist, and he would make sketches of people and so on. But the rest is history in terms of his becoming a troubadour, if you will, a kind of musical bard. And one of the stories he told me that was so significant, I'll repeat it here for you as well, and our deep listeners, is that he came to real prominence, as we know, in Woodstock in 1969 by being the opening act, the opening singer. And he told me about that experience as follows. He said, he was in the motel waiting his turn. He was supposed to be the 5th or 6th act to go on. And Mike, I forget his last name, who was one of the promoters, came to him and said, look, the natives are getting restless. The fences are down. We can't collect any ticket money. They're waiting to have some entertainment. We're worried that the restlessness might turn kind of ugly. And we've been on the phone with financiers in New York, and they've agreed to loan us some money against the movie rights, and they recognize something special is happening here. We've gotten the National Guard to lease to us on credit a Huey helicopter, and we want you to get in it right now and go and be the very first person on stage, because you're essentially acoustic. You only need minimal amplification. We're having a lot of trouble with the sound system and so on. So he winds up, this is during the Vietnam War, in a Huey helicopter being ferried across these fields of farmland in New York State in the late afternoon, brilliant sunshine. And he said, Duncan, I saw field after field after field after field of people. And I can tell you for absolute certain there were well over 1 million people there, even though the crowd official estimate was 500,000. And I saw the irony of being in the Huey helicopter, which was the same thing being used in Vietnam, flying into this gathering called a gathering of 3 days of peace and music. And it occurred to me, they can't hide us anymore. And that became the title of his autobiography. And he told me that when he got on stage and sang his famous song, which we all remember as Freedom, you know, the sort of the masculine element of liberty, contrasted, we might say, with the feminine nurturing element of life, if we talk about life and liberty, the emphasis was on freedom. And people remember that part of it. But he said that the heart of it for him was that he had received a great deal of that song from his grandmother, who was only one generation away from having been a slave.
Yeah.
And the heart of the song was, I got a telephone in my heart with a direct line to God.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually the secret, self-secret message that was encoded in an unconscious ritual to set the foundation for that great gathering at Woodstock. And the media, of course, picked up only on the surface proclamation of freedom, but the deep establishment of that great gathering traced its roots all the way back to that deep sense of spiritual connectedness and embrace and contact with the larger mystery embodied in those words.
That's great. Needless to say, I saw him in Greenwich Village when he was probably 20 years old or so.
Sure.
Because I used to go there myself, and he was actually acting in the theater at the time and singing in the evenings before he switched over to being a full-time singer. Well, that's a beautiful story, and let's hope the idea could come back again, because we're back in very similar circumstances to what we were at that time.
We are.
And something perhaps hasn't been learned.
That's interesting, too, because, of course, both these things, life and liberty, are multivalent. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in terms of the origin of life coming out of a matrix, a nutritive matrix of earth and water and flesh. And then when you go into adolescence, you move into what the Ayurveda view would call the masculine elements of fire and air, you know, more like the desert fathers compared to the great subcontinent of India and Mother India. So that's the wonderful thing about myth and its portrayal, as we were talking earlier, that it is multivalent. It has so many rich meanings. And the great myths, like the Shiva Shakti myth, for instance, of India, has times within it when the feminine, the Shakti or the energy, is taking the initiative, and the masculine Shiva or the consciousness is receptive and even inert until awakened by the feminine. And then it switches in this great cosmic dance where the feminine becomes receptive and the masculine becomes proactive and penetrating to plant the seed of creation in the womb. And the great cosmic dance of masculine and feminine continues in ways in which both energies have at one time or another the same characteristics. And that is, again, a beautiful way of leading us into a discussion of what matters. Because when we say what matters, we're using the word matter, which is the cognate for matrix, mater, mythos even, so that in a way the great receptacle, the great nurturing womb of the mystery through which we all have to pass is indeed what matters. Because unless we can bring the great noble ideals proclaimed, sometimes we say, by the transcendent tree function in the hoop and tree dyad, sometimes thought of as the masculine or the spirit, contrasted with the soul or the feminine or matter. Unless we can bring those two together, we're actually bereft on both sides. And that seems to be one way of looking at our modern mind dilemma and how it is reflected in the world, where, from my point of view, for instance, I see modern culture altogether as being in an adolescent phase of development. And perhaps the industrialized countries of the West, we could say, are latter stage adolescent, and the Muslim fundamentalists that they are in great warfare with are perhaps an earlier stage of adolescence on a linear way of looking at it. But it does seem almost like gang warfare, the very kind of thing that you encountered at the age of 13, and both sides awaiting the proclamation or the singing or the telling of a great unifying story that can touch the hearts of people of all genders and all nationalities to provide a way out of this kind of adolescent warfare.
That's an interesting idea. I certainly agree that part of the problem, or part of the reason for the incredible violence, which even as we speak today is really underway and inching ever closer to the source places of the three great monolithic religions.
Yes, indeed.
One of the reasons for that is that we are mythless. Mm-hmm. We are uncovered and unprotected and less nuanced because we are not wrapped in the thread of a shared and unifying myth. And as soon as you take away that kind of protection, then you tend to have polarization in the extreme. And unfortunately, the polarization becomes literalized. It becomes literal polarity rather than you can have, like Shiva and Shakti is the mythic polarity.
And the dynamic balance, yes.
And the beauty of the dance.
Exactly.
And when you take away the covering, in a sense, that, you know, there's an old idea that the two great garments of the world are the green garment of nature and the multifaceted garment of myth. And the strange thing is they both go at the same time because they are truly not separated. And so you have now people literally, through the holes in the ozone, exposed to the damaging, although invisible, rays of the sun. And then, I think similarly, through the holes in the mythic covering of that culture is supposed to provide, you have people exposed to invisible but very damaging rays of literalism. And so you have a, you know, we have a major mythless condition. Now, some people think that they have to quickly make a myth to plug the holes or recover everybody or reunite everyone, and I happen to think that that's very unlikely. Some people think that a new myth has to occur, and I'm not sure what they mean, but one of the things that I am intrigued with, since I'm not sure how this so-called new mythology stuff happens, since myth has this kind of quality of always reaching back, I pay a lot of attention to the stories that survive when the big myths self-destruct or are deconstructed or whatever it's going to be on a given epoch. In other words, if you imagine the big civilized centers, which have been often the places holding the myth or even the tribal camp, when you imagine that what holds it together rattling and perhaps disappearing, there are still the small stories that people carry. For instance, I tell this Native American story of why the world doesn't end, which is a story that might live a lot longer than the big myths of why the world does end. And so there's what I call folk myths or little living myths that show ways of survival and ways of having a mythic connection and a mythic covering when the big mythic vehicles are cracking and can't hold the water of life.
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, because one thinks that in terms of that which survives, we can see a great fire next time, as is one of the apocalyptic expressions, with seedlings buried down below, the power of the small close to the earth, feeling the nutritive coolness of the earth itself as the great fire rages above, will be the seedlings of the new greenery and forest that will come. And perhaps we could conclude on that notion, as we've suddenly come to the end of this dialogue, Michael, with the invitation to our deep listeners to be with us again as we take on this very topic of what myths may arise and or survive or self-destruct in our time. And with that, Michael Mead, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on Living Dialogues, and what a real enchanting delight it is to tell stories back and forth, knowing that we have a truly deep listening audience that's evoking this particular dialogue.
Great. Well, thank you, Duncan. It's good to talk about myth.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. Be with us again as we continue on Living Dialogues. And visit us on my website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. And if you'd like to listen freely to additional archived visionary dialogues with myself and other transformational thinkers listed on my livingdialogues.com website, once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. Or simply browse through the list of programs here whenever you like, download them, or listen to them on your computer. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.